Welcome to Podski Wee Wee. I'm Josh Smith.
And I'm Mike Graham.
All right, Mike, we're just going to skip any chit-chat and small talk. Let's just get right into this game because of how exciting it was. Ticats beat the Argos on Sunday in the East semifinal on a last-second field goal by Justin Medlock. I'm at a loss for words, man. It was something special.
It was just a really exciting ending to the game. You know, for part of the game, I really thought that Hamilton was going to go down, but they fought back and kicked the last-second field goal. You know, Medlock was on point all game. The game was a story of two kickers, really, because Medlock was just amazing, and then Swayze Waters was just terrible, which is very surprising, because I always thought that Swayze Waters was one of the best kickers in the league. Medlock and Waters, I always thought, were one and two. So just a defensive struggle at first, but then it started to pick up, and it turned out to be a really entertaining game and a great game because the Ticats won.
Special teams all around were great for the Ticats, I thought, yesterday. Brandon Banks didn't break one for a touchdown, but he had a lot of good returns. And I'm kind of wondering, Waters, you're right, was a little iffy, I guess you could say, on his kicks. And he wasn't doing kickoffs. And he had that punt where he went to recover it, but he booted it, and they didn't get the ball. And that could have been a huge turning point for them. Do you think maybe his time off messed with his mojo a little bit? Because you're right, he is one of the best kickers in the league. If it's not Medlock, it's him. Those two guys are to me, 1-2, just like you said.
It could have been the time off. He's a really good punter, too. He had such a big opportunity to collect that punt, and it would have been such a big momentum switch for the Argos, and he just totally messed it up. And then missed his two field goals. You know, that's 6 points. That would have put the Argos on top. So, you know, it's not all his fault, obviously, but it was a really bad game for him. He probably feels terrible about it.
So where do you rank Medlock's kick in all-time Ticats lore? To me, I would say it's number three behind Ian Sunter in 72, because that kick was in Hamilton and won a Grey Cup. And then, of course, Ozzie's kick in 98 in the East Final that got them to the Grey Cup. This didn't advance them as far as those kicks. It's definitely going to be one that goes down in the history books and will be one we're telling our grandkids and their grandkids will tell their kids about it and all that sort of stuff. Do you have it as the number three kick in team history? Because that's where I have it.
Yeah, it's got to be, you know, me and you weren't alive in 72, so, but you just look back and, home Grey Cup, last second field goal for the win over the Rough Riders. And then I was there in 98 for the Ospaldsson kick, 54-yarder. You know, they get the ball. Montreal scores a touchdown with 24 seconds left, I believe. Hamilton gets the ball back. They drive down the field. They get close enough to get Ozzie out there and kick that field goal. For me, that's number one. But yeah, it's got to go 1-2 either way, the 72 and the 98. And then this one this week was just a huge kick as well. So number one for me is always going to be Ozzie because I was there and that meant a trip to the Grey Cup. But this one ranks up there very high as well.
Yeah, I'm sure the people who were alive for the 72 kick would rank that number one. But Ozzie's number one for me, too, just like you. I was sitting in the stands when it happened. And I think we've talked about this on the show before, that the hugs and the high fives of complete strangers that I never met before and probably never saw again after the Ozzie kick was something that I will keep with me for the rest of my life. And as my brain fires its last synapses, that's probably going to be something I remember. But this ranks pretty high up there because this team was not given any chance to win this game. If you look at all the prognostications and all the picks from all the so-called experts out there, everyone was taking the Argos. And to be fair, I was not all that confident in the Ticats getting this win either because they essentially were without a quarterback. And that's, I'm not trying to be insulting to Jeremiah Masoli, but he had not performed exceptionally well in previous outings. So there was definitely some hesitation on my part to really think the Ticats would win this. And then when they went down 18-6 late in the third quarter, I was ready to send out a tweet being like, I guess we all kind of know that this season's over and what a disappointment it would be. But I held off, and then Masoli drives him down the field and they score that touchdown on Bakari Grant making an excellent double move and the Argo player falling down because of it. And he walks in the end zone and slowly but surely the Ticats started to chip away. And a lot of that is due to Masoli's play. He was I think we can both agree, terrible in the first half and a bit of the game. He was 5 for 11 for 26 yards, and then he threw an interception right after the Ticats had gotten an interception, and it looked like it was shades of Ottawa all over again, where the Ticats get a turnover, and then they turn the ball right back over, and you're thinking, oh my God, not again. And then he gets benched, and they bring in Ja'Cory Harris for a couple of series, and he didn't really do all that much. And then Masoli came back in and looked like a completely different player. He goes 7 for 7 for 117 yards and one passing touchdown, and then he scored the rushing touchdown late that put them up, and he just really seemed to have a fire lit under him after that benching. Did you notice sort of the same thing?
You know, really early on, they got didn't look too terrible. You know, they got the two field goals to be up 6-0 in the first quarter, and then it seemed that he was throwing high a lot of the time to receivers, and he just couldn't get in a rhythm. So yeah, when they brought in Ja'Cory Harris, I didn't like that move. I have more confidence in Mazzoli than Harris. And then you're right, they bring him back in, and he's a totally different player. He, you know, we got to talk about Gable, too. Gable started running the ball in the second half, which really helped Mazzoli as well. Gable, on the touchdown pass drive, had a nice run, like, right before that. And then Mazzoli throws the touchdown pass down the sidelines where the Argos defender fell down, and Bakari Grant just was wide open and walked into the end zone. So up to that point, I was really worried, like you, because the offense wasn't showing anything. The defense was playing amazing, keeping them in the game. But then they got that touchdown, and it seemed to really switch the game around.
Well, it lit the crowd on fire. The crowd was pretty down because that touchdown came right after the Argos had scored. So, like I said, I could get the sense that people seemed to be resigned to the fact that this was the end of the season. And then that just lit a fire under everyone in the stands, and I really think, and I don't like to give fans too much credit for affecting the game on the field, but I really think that that lit a fire under the team, because they were on the bench, and I could see it myself, because I'm right above them. They're hooting and hollering, they're trying to get everyone involved. It just seemed like that was the turning point of the game, and I you know, that's an obvious thing to say, because from then on, the Ticats went on to win the game, but it just seemed like that pulling of Mazzoli, and the way he took it, because it's from all the post-game talk, Austin said that the plan was always to put him back in. I'm sure if Ja'Cory Harris would have gone in there and thrown together two touchdown drives, I doubt Masoli gets back in the game. But he gets back in the game, and he seemed to have taken that benching really well, and it seemed to focus him. I don't know if this will work again going forward, and I'm hoping that he doesn't play terribly against Ottawa next week in the East Final to necessitate a benching of any sort. But I was just most impressed with the fact that he did not take it and sulk about it, and he just went out and played ball, man. He didn't have an incompletion the rest of the game, and that speaks for itself.
Yeah, I was impressed with that as well. You know, there's been some questions in the past about Mazzoli's maturity, perhaps, and he really showed that he's matured quite a bit with that benching. You know, a lot of players would have sulked and been really mad about the situation, but he came back in the game and really helped the Ticats. You know, they really lifted the Ticats up and really helped them win this game. So he has got to be the guy going forward. You know, he's the guy. It's got to be Mazzoli. It can't be Harris, because he just hasn't shown anything, really. I think Mazzoli has a bet. He can be a pretty decent passer, and he's an option. He can run the ball too. So I'm just have my fingers crossed that we see the second half Mazzoli in the game next week against Ottawa for the whole game.
We kind of brushed over your CJ Gable comment, and I want to go back to that, because in the second half of the game, they started giving him the ball a lot more, and he looked like the CJ Gable that we all know and love. He was picking up huge chunks of yardage. He was making defenders miss. He was spinning out of tackles. He was fighting for those extra yards. It was just really, really nice to see.
Absolutely. It's great to see him back looking like he did a couple years ago. His leg got hit, and he did a spin in the air like he did a couple years ago when they were in Guelph, and it just had a flashback to that amazing run. But yeah, you got to give credit to the O-line too. They opened up some great holes for him to run through, and you know, if we can get him rolling, we have a shot at this.
There is some negatives to come out of this game, unfortunately, and those are a pair of injuries to some pretty key players. It looks to me, from what I'm seeing on social media and in some circles, that Eric Norwood's season is over. I saw a tweet earlier talking about a possible torn ACL, so that's really unfortunate, because he has been maybe Hamilton's best defensive lineman when he's out there. He's missed a lot of games this season, but he's always been an impact player. And Terrell Sinkfield missed most of that game, so I'm hoping Sinkfield's injury, it seemed to be an ankle issue they kept hearing, so I'm hoping that can be fixed, because he would be a big loss if he's out for the Ottawa game. So those two injuries kind of temper my excitement for the game, but not too much. But it's just something we kind of have to address.
Yeah, it's been a tough go for Norwood this year. He just can't seem to stay healthy. If it's a torn ACL, that's, you know, terrible news for him, terrible news for the team. I hope it's not, but it does look that way, that he's going to be out for the rest of the playoffs. So we're just going to have to plug and play, you know, next guy up, see if, you know, it's going to test our depth, but hopefully someone can go in there and do a good job, because we need that pass rush. We just need it badly. I think we had it pretty good against Toronto in the semifinal, especially in the middle. You had Atkinson with a sack, Laurent with two sacks, so in the defensive line in the middle was doing a hell of a job. Hickman's going to have to step up his game with Norwood out. So, and then Sinkfield, that's a tough loss as well. He's been so good this year that we've talked about it a lot on the podcast this season. He's just really stepped up his game, and he's a really dangerous threat out there in the receiving corps. So I hope his injury isn't as serious as Norwood's and he can be back and can have his full speed for the game against Ottawa. But if not, they're just going to have to find someone else to fill a spot. Maybe Banks gets more playing time in the offense.
So there was a bit of controversy in this game. Near the end of the game, there was a roughing the passer penalty called on Toronto, I can't remember his name, Martin Wright or something like that, I think it is, number 79, I believe. And his assertion after the game was that he was pushed in the back by a Ticats offensive lineman, which caused him to roll into Jeremiah Masoli's leg, which caused the penalty. Now, as we all know, we dealt with whether hitting a quarterback low, when and where, and we went through all that stuff with the Simone Lawrence hit on Henry Burris a couple weeks back, but this was an obviously different scenario. Masoli was in the pocket in the throwing position, and they threw the flag. Now, Wright says it was a completely bogus call, but I had a chance to go back and watch the game, and I especially paid attention to that play. And while Mark Dial, definitely puts his hands on Wright, he didn't shove him in the way that Wright asserts that he did. At best, he nudged him or put a hand on his back. It was not this like two-handed shove that he's out there saying it is. And the league has come out and said that the penalty met the standard and that you can't go low on a quarterback and you can't go low and late on a quarterback. So it was the league says it's the right call. I didn't see much in the way of any disputable evidence that it wouldn't have been the right call. What are your thoughts?
It I agree. It was the right call. I watched the replay as well on the highlights on the Ticats website. I watched all the highlights and I watched that play, and there wasn't a shove. He just, you know, maybe he didn't mean to go low. You know, maybe he's just trying to make a tackle, but that's the rule. You can't go below the knees. So the right call was made. It was very unfortunate for the Argos that happened. But, you know, tough luck. That's the rule. So I was shocked when I saw that the flag was thrown. I could have sworn it would have been Cleon Lang, because we know his reputation for taking dumb penalties. But it was that right guy. So, yeah, it was the right call, and it helped the Ticats immensely, but the right call was made on the field.
The Argos took quite a few dumb penalties, I found. I think it was the Brandon Banks return after the conceded safety. And it's funny because in watching the replay, they didn't show it on the TV, but in person, they throw a flag, and it ends up being on number 36 for the Argos' roll. And he, which you guys didn't see, you only would have seen in the stadium, he starts going over to the flag and starts pointing at it and like gesturing like, no, it's on Hamilton. And he was being kind of demonstrative about it, being a little bit of a jackass, to be honest. And then the penalty flag ends up being on him. And it all gave us, or at least the people I was sitting with, gave us a good chuckle in the stands. Whenever Hamilton needed to make a play, Toronto helped them out by taking these dumb ass penalties, and those are just two instances, because I believe the Ticats went down and scored a touchdown on that drive, so it seemed like as good as the Ticats played, the Argos definitely helped them out a bit.
Yeah, that's been the story for the Argos all year. They've been taking dumb penalties all season long, so yeah, it bit them in the ass again, and they just have to be more disciplined. They can't be taking dumb penalties in playoff games.
The offensive line, to me, was also on point. They gave up a little bit of pressure, and I think there may have been a sack or two. I know Ja'Cory Harris got sacked once when he was in the game, and Masoli, when he was running, I think one time ran out of bounds or got tackled behind the line of scrimmage on a scramble, which is, it's a sack, but it's really like a sack in name only. But I thought for the most part the offensive line was really good. You mentioned how they opened holes for Gable. I thought they gave Masoli a lot of time back there. I just thumbs up to the offensive line because that defensive line in Toronto is really good when they want to be, and I think Hamilton held their own.
Yeah, they did. They did a great job. Masoli had a bunch of time back there, so they just have to keep doing that going forward against Ottawa, which we'll get into in the game preview. But Ottawa's a tougher test than Toronto on that D-line, so hopefully they can continue playing a great game next week.
So I am all talked out about this game. I'm still ecstatic about the win. I think I will be until kickoff Sunday for the East Final. This, to me, was if the last game of the season in Hamilton is going to be a win, and it's going to be a last-second win, and it's going to come off the boot of one of my favorite players, even though he's a kicker, I love Justin Medlock, and I've liked him for a very long time. I liked him when he was with Toronto. I thought he was a great kicker, and I'm glad he's here. There's no better way to end the home season period in Hamilton than with an elimination game with them eliminating the Argos. To me, it's the perfect way to end the season.
It was fun to watch, that's for sure. Now, I just want to give a quick shout-out to Brandon Stewart as well. You know, he had a big play. The Argos were driving. They threw a long bomb right near the goal line, and there was two Argos in the vicinity, and Brandon Stewart came up and jumped up and really knocked the ball down to save maybe the game for the Ticats. So I know that he gets a lot of heat, but that was a great play by him.
I think he has really stepped up his play, honestly, and I think we can attribute that to he was not a starter to start the season, and he was on special teams, and he was put in situations where he could excel, and I think the fact that we don't hear anyone this year harping on his poor play or harping on his play at all tells me that he's really sort of advanced as a player and become a guy that can contribute on this team, because you're right, he was a bit of a, not a whipping boy necessarily, because he did get a lot of deserved attention for some poor play, especially last year in the playoffs when he got beat by SG Green. But we've talked about that ad nauseum. That's last year, and that this is a different season. But no, I've really been high on Stewart's play this year, and I think he's really come around to become a really valuable member of this team.
For sure. Totally agree. Glad to see him do well this season.
So, bold prediction time. We whiffed on these, but I don't think either of us really care considering the outcome of the game. But you had CJ Gable going for over 100 yards and a pair of touchdowns, and he had 89 yards on the ground and 19 yards through the air, and he didn't score any touchdowns, but that was still a darn good game. So I don't think you're at all unimpressed or angry with the output that CJ Gable put out, even though you didn't get your bold prediction correct.
Not at all. I'm just happy that the team won.
And I had the Ticats defense getting three interceptions of Ricky Ray and scoring a touchdown. They only picked off the one pass, but it was a pretty big interception for Emmanuel Davis right at the start of the second half. The Ticats turned the ball back over, but it was still a good play, and that was the only interception of the day, and the defense didn't score a touchdown. But just like you, they got the win, so I don't really care. So let's talk a little bit about some Ticats stuff before we get into some more games and all that stuff that's going on in the league. But the Division All-Star announcements came out last week after we had recorded the show, and the Ticats had eight of them. Luke Tasker, Ryan Bombin, Ted Laurent, Simone Lawrence, Emmanuel Davis, Craig Butler, Justin Medlock, and Brandon Banks were all named East Division All-Stars. I don't really think there's much of a surprise on that list. Maybe Butler. I was maybe a little surprised that he became an All-Star, but other than that, I think those eight guys are well-deserving of All-Star recognition.
Yeah, all of them. You know, I thought that Butler had a better year. He was more noticeable this year than last year, but yeah, slightly surprised that he was on that team, but all the others, not surprised at all.
Actually, speaking of Butler, going back to the game, he had a really nice play. It was Toronto's last offensive play. They brought a safety blitz, and he disguised it perfectly. Hit Ray, caused the ball to fly up in the air, could have been intercepted, landed on the ground, and forced Toronto to kick the field goal that tied the game and saved some time for the Ticats to go down and win the ballgame on the last-second field goal. So big ups to Craig Butler. But I kind of want to talk about three players that didn't make the team that I feel maybe we're snubbed slightly. Terrell Sinkfield, obviously, is one of them. Mike Filer is the other, and Courtney Steven. So Filer was not named the East All-Star Center, but John Gott from the Ottawa Redblacks was. And we kind of talked about this when we were talking about most outstanding lineman recognition. It's really hard to decipher who does what and where on the offensive line. It's like we said, when they're screwing up, we sort of notice them, but when they don't, we don't really pay that much attention. I just think Filer deserved recognition because of how far he's come. I'm really not sure how good Gott has been. That Ottawa offensive line has been really good. I personally voted for Filer as the center, but I guess others didn't see the same way I did. But with the other two guys that I think were quote-unquote snubbed, Sinkfield to me should have been on this team. The all-star wide receivers were Luke Tasker, Brad Sinopoli, Chris Williams, and SJ Green, and I would have taken Sinkfield over Sinopoli. They had a five-yard difference in receiving yards. Sinopoli finished 5 yards ahead of Sinkfield, but Sinkfield had twice the amount of touchdown catches. He had 6 to Sinopoli's 3, and his yards per catch average was higher. So Sinkfield to me was the more explosive player, and he had these numbers, which were close to or better than Sinopoli's in only 15 games, whereas Sinopoli played all 18. I think Sinkfield should have been on this team ahead of Sinopoli.
Yeah, I was just going to mention the number of games played because Sinkfield was out for a couple. Like you said, only played 15 games. So yeah, if the stats are that close and he has 3 less games, you know, you think you have to go with Sinkfield. But, you know, Sinopoli's had a great year. But if I would have had the choice, I would have went with Sinkfield. And not just because I'm a huge Ticats fan, but because I think he deserves to be on that all-star team.
Yeah, I think Sinopoli had a great year, and I'm not trying to really take anything away from him, but they were so close, and Sinkfield had more TDs, and that to me says something as well. He also had much bigger plays. Sinopoli's longest reception was nowhere near close to Sinkfield, so I just feel like as a playmaker, Sinkfield deserved recognition for the season he had. And you know what? If someone tells me that maybe Sinkfield should have been on the team ahead of Tasker, I would accept that too. I think Williams and Green were no-brainers, but I would have taken Sink over Tasker, or Sink over Sinopoli, I mean. And Courtney Steven, I just feel like he gets overlooked sometimes, and he was in at cornerback, and the two cornerbacks that were picked were Abdul Kane from Ottawa and Javon Johnson from Ottawa. Kane led the league in interceptions, so I guess I understand why he would be on there. It's kind of hard to have an all-star team without putting one of the corners out there who led the league in INTs. But Steven and Johnson's stats were really similar, and I think maybe Johnson got the bump because of how much better Ottawa was. But I think I would have really liked to have seen Courtney Steven make the all-star team.
You know, I think that Filer and Steven and Sinkfield will all be future all-stars. So I think their careers are on the rise, and we will see them on the all-star team, you know, for years to come. So I think Steven has really stepped up his game. I really like him in the secondary. So, yeah, I would have loved to see him on this year, but I think he'll be on there maybe next year or the year after that.
So are you ready to have a little fun with some player awards? The last few weeks we've done this where, as I said before, I am a voter on the CFL awards. So I've made my picks, and I like to throw them out to you to get your opinion, and then we get to go a little back and forth. Are you ready to do it this week?
Yes, sir.
All right. So Coach of the Year, they changed up how they're doing Coach of the Year this year. And instead of it being 3 finalists and having the award handed out in like February, they're actually doing it at the award ceremony before the Grey Cup. So they did the same thing with coaches as they did with the players. And it's one from the West and one from the East. The East nominee is Rick Campbell from Ottawa, which isn't really that much of a surprise. And it's Chris Jones from Edmonton on the other side. Again, not much of a surprise. So between those two, who are you taking as Coach of the Year?
That's a tough one. Chris Jones has really done a great job since he's been in Edmonton, you know, really helped turn around the Eskimos franchise. But I got to go with Campbell. You know, it's just so impressive. 2 wins to 12 wins is just too hard to overlook. You know, we both said we'd take Milanovic in the East, but since he didn't make it, I got to go with Campbell.
Campbell was my pick as well. I tried to think of a reason to pick Jones. Edmonton, 14-4 season, first in the West. The adversity of dealing with not having Mike Riley for a large part of the season and them really not missing a beat. They've won something like 7 or 8 in a row going into the playoffs. But the turnaround that Ottawa took this year from 2 wins to 12 is incredible, and it's hard not to give it to Campbell. Campbell definitely deserves it. He's the guy that got the votes, the majority of the votes. Yeah, I took Campbell as my coach of the year. So most outstanding special teams player, we have Hamilton's Brandon Banks against Calgary's Rene Paradis. Who do you got?
Banks. Gotta go Banks. He just brings so much to the Ticats. Field position, touchdowns, offensive play. I'm sure Paradis has had a great season, but I gotta go with Brandon Banks.
Brandon Banks got my vote as well. It's a kick returner versus a kicker, and a kicker can only have so much effect on the game. Brandon Banks is dangerous whenever he has the football. I talked about him earlier. He didn't have a return against Toronto, but he set up the Ticats in great field position all afternoon against Toronto. So I think that the two best special teams players play in Hamilton, and that's Banks and Medlock. I think Medlock is more deserving of recognition than Paredes, and Paredes is a good kicker, and he had a good year. But yeah, Brandon Banks was the no-brainer choice for me on this one. Most outstanding offensive lineman is coming down to Ottawa's Sir Vincent Rogers and BC's Jovan Olafioye. Who do you got?
This is always tough for the O-line, but I think I gave praise to Sir Vincent Rogers in a previous episode, just the way that they've turned around that offensive line in Ottawa. I got to go with Sir Vincent Rogers. You know, he kind of under the radar. You know, I think I'm basically repeating myself, but he was under the radar because of the signing in Winnipeg with Stanley Bryant. So I got to go Sir Vincent Rogers.
Yeah, I took Rogers as well. He transformed that Ottawa offensive line. And I don't think there's really much else that needs to be said. So most outstanding rookie comes down to Toronto's Vidal Hazelton and Edmonton's Darrell Walker. I think this one is going to be an easy pick.
You got to go Darrell Walker. I mean, he set records this season. He's a future star in the making. Hazelton had a really good start to the season. He's kind of fell off near the end of the season. I think he was benched for off-the-field problems or just attitude problems. So Darrell Walker has just been amazing in Edmonton. He had that huge game in the last game of the season against Montreal to clinch first place. He has just been performing all season long. So I'm sure you went with Walker as well. I got to go Darrell Walker.
You got two receivers going up against each other. It's pretty easy. You just look at the numbers, and whoever had better numbers was the more outstanding player. And Walker beat Hazelton in every category. The only one that they're even close in, really, is touchdown catches. They both had six, but Walker had 89 receptions to Hazelton's 70. Walker had 1,110 yards to Hazelton's 803. Walker's average catch was 12.5 yards. Hazelton's was 11.5. There's no statistical measure in which Hazelton had a better season, so yeah, it was a complete no-brainer. Darrell Walker for most outstanding rookie. Now let's get to most outstanding Canadian, and this one I think might be the hardest one to pick out of all the awards. We have Ottawa's Brad Sinopoli representing the East and Winnipeg's Jamal Westerman representing the West. Who do you got?
Ooh. Wow, that is tough. Oh, boy. I think Westerman led the league in sacks. Am I correct?
I think he finished second behind John Bowman.
Oh,
he had
17,
John and Bowman had 19.
Yeah. Wow, that's a tough one. Really tough. Sinopoli had a great year. I'm going to have to go with Westerman, though. He you know, sometimes players from he was a starter in the NFL for a couple of years, I believe, had a good career down there. And sometimes when they come to the CFL, their mojo's kind of gone. They're not quite as motivated. But, wow, what a year from Westerman. He just comes into the league and sets it on fire. 17 sacks is amazing. I just got to go with him.
That's who I picked as well. I think he was one of the few bright spots for a Winnipeg team that was pretty bad for most of the season, but he just always was out there making plays. It seemed like every game I watched, he had a sack. So it was Westerman to me. Like, Sinopoli had a good year, but he was in a receiving corps that had Chris Williams, who went over 1,000 yards, and Greg Ellingson, who went over 1,000 yards, and Ernest Jackson, who went over 1,000 yards. And that kind of took pressure and focus away from Sinopoli, whereas every team would go into a game against Westerman and would game plan to stop him, and they just couldn't. He was a beast out there. And yeah, to me, he is the most outstanding Canadian. So let's move on to most outstanding defensive player. And we have Hamilton's Simone Lawrence representing the East and BC's Adam Big Hill representing the West. Who do you have for this one, sir?
You know, I think I picked Simone Lawrence to win this award at the start of the season. I'd love to go with Lawrence, but I gotta go with Big Hill. He's like you called Westerman. He's a beast out there. He took over the leadership reins in the linebacking corps of BC when Elamimian went down. He's just been flying around all year like he's done in the past. So was he the tackling leader this year?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he finished in the tops in tackles. Let me just check, but I almost don't have to look, but I'm fairly certain he led the league in tackles. Yes, he did. He led with 117, three more than Saskatchewan's Jeff Knox Jr.
Ooh, Jeff Knox Jr. with a very good season as well. Yeah, I got to go Big Hill. Simone Lawrence is one of my favorite players on the Ticats, but I got to go Big Hill for most outstanding defensive player.
So last week I mentioned that I picked Lawrence as the East nominee and kind of regretted it after I'd made the selection, thinking, you know what, I should have probably taken Winston Venable. So I was a little surprised that Lawrence got the nomination, and I picked him for most outstanding defensive player. Mm-hmm. Big Hill had a great season, and I'm not taking anything away from that. And his numbers were better, especially tackle-wise, than Lawrence's. But Lawrence is a different type of linebacker. He's in that Markeith Knowlton mold where he might not register a ton of tackles, but he's out there getting fumbles, forcing fumbles, getting interceptions, getting some sacks, just making big plays. Big Hill makes big plays as well, but I think he's more of your traditional middle linebacker. So yeah, I went with the game breaker, and maybe a little bit of it was a homer pick in taking Simone Lawrence, but yeah, I went with Simone Lawrence. But it wasn't an easy pick. Now that leads us to the final award, which is most outstanding player. And we mentioned last week that this would probably be a short conversation. I expect it will still be a short conversation. Henry Burris from Ottawa is representing the East, and Bo Levi Mitchell, the quarterback from the Calgary Stampeders, is representing the West. So tell everybody why you're taking Henry Burris.
Just numbers, pretty much. I mean, he's had an outstanding season, but he hasn't had, you know, a ton of TD passes, but the yards are just far and above Mitchell's yards. I think, you know, Mitchell had 4,500 passing yards and he played every game. So that's not like overly impressive in the CFL to me. If you play 18 games and you're a most outstanding player, you should be over 5,000 yards. I'm not saying it's easy to throw for 5,000 yards, but if you're up for that MOP, I think you should have that. He just had such a turnaround year. He's really blended well with those receivers that they brought in the offseason, just night and day compared to last year. You know, last year, I noticed on Twitter a lot of Ottawa fans were calling for his head, get him out of there, bring in the young guys behind him. And this year is just totally different. So, you know, Burris being 40, it just makes it even that more impressive. He's just been so dependable this year. I got to give it to him.
Much like with most outstanding rookie, we have two players who play the same position, and they both finish with the same amount of touchdown passes, 26. They both finished with the same amount of interceptions, 13. Burris was almost at 71% completion percentage. Mitchell was at 65.6. And Burris had nearly almost 1,200 yards, more passing yards than Mitchell. Mitchell missed the last game of the season. They sat him against BC because it meant nothing. But he wasn't going to throw for 1,200 yards in that game, so he wasn't going to catch Burris. These two guys are very close, but Burris has the better numbers, and like you said, at 40 years old, for him to have the season he had, it's hard not to make him the MOP. Let's do what we did last week, and let's give a little preview for the other playoff game. We're going to get into a really in-depth East final preview, but let's do a little small West final preview, and I think if we go back and look at our predictions from the start of the season, I'm pretty sure this is the game that we had. I'm pretty sure this is the game that nearly everyone would have had as the West Final. Maybe not where it's being played, but it was definitely these two teams battling it out for the right to go to the Grey Cup. And it's Calgary at Edmonton. Calgary put a beating on BC in the West Semi, and now they get to head to Edmonton and take on a supremely rested Eskimo squad. So what are you looking for in this game, and who do you think's going to win?
Well, I'm looking at Edmonton's offense because they've been a question mark all season long. They seem to have they turned it on really well in the last game of the season where they had to win against Montreal to clinch first place. I'm looking at how they perform. I'm looking at how Calgary's offense performs as well because they've been good, but they haven't been great. So both good defenses, both potentially good offenses. I think this could be a classic of a game. I will be attending this game. I'm looking at the weather. You know, hopefully it's not. If it's really cold and snowing, you know, it could be a defensive struggle with these two teams having great defenses. So it's going to be interesting to see if Edmonton gets Shakir Bell back and if they sign Grigsby, if they use him, or if Chad Simpson's in there. I think they had a couple more injuries that I think J.C. Sherrick got nicked up too. I'm not sure if he's going to be back. So I'm looking at pretty much everything, offense, defense, and seeing what injured players are now healthy to be back in the lineup. So it should be a great Western final.
If the weather gets cold, I expect we're going to see a lot of Jerome Messam for Calgary. I think the one thing we can be for certain about is this is going to be a low-scoring game. These two teams played three times this season, and Calgary never scored more than 16 points. They beat Edmonton on Labor Day 16-7. They lost in the rematch 6 days later, 27-16, and then they lost, which was essentially a win and you're going to get home field advantage game in October, 15-11. So Edmonton's defense has found a way to contain Calgary's offense, but Jerome Messam did not play in any of those games, and with the way he played against BC, he had one of the nicest catch and runs I've ever seen. It was just a straight bulldoze run. Mitchell found him out of the backfield. He made Big Hill miss, the West nominee for most sustained defensive player, and they just took off down the sidelines. He's not the quickest of guys. He's more of a bruiser, but he got a pretty big chunk of yardage there and got caught late. But I'm really curious to see how this Edmonton team stacks up against Jerome Messam. I know that they played Messam when he was with Saskatchewan, but this Calgary team is a lot better than that Rough Riders team, obviously. So I think that's the matchup I'm most interested in watching.
Yeah, I think they're going to utilize Messam quite a bit. He might be the best player in the league right now. You talked about he doesn't have tremendous speed, but when he gets going, he can run pretty fast once he gets his legs churning. You know, he doesn't start off fast, but once he gets going, he's tough to bring down, and he has some pretty good speed. So, I'm looking at him. I'm looking how Paul Levi Mitchell plays. Like you said, he's had Calgary's offense has had a tough go against Edmonton this year, so especially him. So I'm going to have an eye on him and Messam this game. Hopefully it's not too low of a scoring, because I'd like to see not a 10-7 game, but the offensive weapons are there to make it a high scoring game. But I just think those two defenses are too good to make it a real shootout.
Maybe this is going to be the game of the playoffs, because these two teams, obviously, this is like kind of a duh thing to say, but they're obviously so evenly matched. They both finished 14-4. The point differential between the two in the games that they played against one another is minimal. This is going to be a really tight game. So I'm going to put you on the spot. We didn't do this last week, but we're doing it this week. Who do you got?
It's a real tough one. You know, Calgary's a great team. Edmonton's a great team. Like you said, both 14-4. I got to go with Edmonton. I just think their defense is better than Calgary's defense. I think they're going to be highly motivated to win this game. You know, over 40,000 tickets are sold for the game. I'm hoping they get close to 50,000. I think it's going to be cold weather, which will lean towards the defensive game. So I just got to give it to Edmonton because of the, you know, their defense all year long has been spectacular. So, yeah, I think it's going to be Edmonton in the Grey Cup for the West, but I think it's going to be a real close game.
I'm going to take the Stampeders. I think Jerome Messam is going to be a difference maker. I think they're going to pound the rock with him. If it's going to be as cold as you're saying it might be out there, the running game, I think, is going to be of paramount importance. And I think Calgary's got the better of the two running backs. I think they have the battle-tested team. They're the defending Grey Cup champions. And I think they want to send John Huffnagel out on their this would be Calgary's first ever back-to-back title wins. I think they want to send Huff out with a championship. I think that those losses to Edmonton early in the season are still weighing heavily on their minds. I'm going to take the Stampeders in a very, very tight contest.
Yeah, that's not a dumb decision at all. You know, I'm looking at the weather right now. It's supposed to be a high of 0 degrees, a low of -6 during the day. So, and some snow/sleet and freezing rain. Oh, in the morning. Okay, flurries in the afternoon. So it's going to be a classic Western final with the flurries falling. So that's, I like to see that. So it's, I don't blame you for going with Calgary. They're a great team. It could go either way, in my opinion.
So let's move to the East, and it's the Ticats and the Red Blacks in Ottawa. Winner goes to the Grey Cup. What are you looking for in this game? How can Hamilton finally get over this inexplicable Ottawa hump? They've lost two in a row to the Red Blacks. This will be the third time they're playing them in 4 weeks. How can the Ticats make this one a victory?
Mazzoli's got to play like he did in the second. He's got to play almost perfect. You know, I don't expect him to win the game solely, but he needs to not turn over the ball. And Gable's got to have a lot of touches, you know, 15 touches, 17 touches, something like that. He's got to gain a lot of ground or a lot of yards on the ground, because that'll help out Mazzoli so much. And I think that Mazzoli has to run the ball a bit. You know, I don't want him to – I want them to allow him to pass the ball. I don't want them to be – him to be running, you know, every second play. But I think there's got to be mixed in there a bit. And I think Banks has to really help us out on special teams, get that maybe a touchdown, get some really good field position for the Ticats, because that's going to help them out a lot.
What I want to see from the passing game is I'd like to see a lot more short throws. I know that – Jeremiah Masoli likes to throw the deep ball. He has a lot of confidence in his arm. They threw a lot of deep passes against the Argos. Luke Tasker and Andy Fantuz were barely involved. Fantuz had one catch for 0 yards.
Yeah.
Tasker, I think, had 2 catches for 19 yards. And Tasker had a great short pass that he broke a tackle, did the Gable spin with the leg in the air, and picked up a first down very late in that game. Those two guys were not utilized very much in the passing attack. No one really was. The Ticats completed, I think, 13 passes in the entire game, and I don't know if any receiver had more than 3 or 4 catches, but I'd really like to see those guys used more, and they're not deep threats. Your deep threats are your Brandon Banks. Even Bakari Grant has become a deep threat, even though he's not the fastest guy in the world, but he still seems to find a way to get open deep, or at least be thrown too deep. And Underwood's a nice intermediate to deep threat, and if Sinkfield's back in there, he's obviously a deep threat. So I really want to see them use the middle of the field and exploit some holes in coverage with Tasker and Fantuz. Those guys need to be involved more. That's what I'm looking for. Shorter to intermediate passing routes instead of just going for the deep ball all the time.
Tasker and Fantuz are just too talented guys to not be involved in this game. They have to get the ball more. You know, depend on Fantuz on those 2nd and 6, 2nd and 7 passes. And count on Tasker's been doing it all season long. Get him the ball more, too. And we didn't touch on this in our when we talked about the Toronto-Hamilton game, but there was a brilliant play call on the drive, the winning drive for the Ticats in the fourth quarter. The first play, they did like a double fake reverse and then a screen pass to Gable, which picked up about 13 yards. That was just amazing play call, and I'd like to see plays like that with screen passes to Gable mixed in there as well.
That was an excellent play call. Not only did it work to perfection, I think they picked up 12 or 13 yards on the play, but Masoli sold it perfectly. Gable sold it perfectly. It was executed to perfection, and I'm with you. A lot more of those. Just getting the ball in CJ Gable's hands, and good things will happen. You mentioned Brandon Banks needs to flip some field. I predicted those two games against Ottawa that he would go off for multiple touchdowns, and he didn't. I still think that they can exploit Ottawa's special teams coverage. I don't think it's that good, and I think even Red Black supporters would say the same thing. Their Achilles heel all season has been special teams. Toronto, for some odd reason, decided that they were just going to punt down the middle and try to let Brandon Banks beat them. I don't think we're going to see the same thing out of Ottawa, but I still think that Brandon Banks can make plays. He had the 127-yard missed extra point, two-point convert return, so if they can get the ball in his hands on special teams and he can make one or two guys miss, I think we could see some big returns. And defensively, I think we talked about this before, they just have to find a way to slow down Ottawa's passing attack. Their rushing attack with Powell is pretty good. I don't think it's as good as it was with Jeremiah Johnson, but it's still pretty good. But it's the passing attack there. They have 4,000-yard receivers and burst through for 5,700 yards almost. There's obviously a lot of firepower in that passing offense. They got to find a way to slow that down. Burris is going to get his yards. He's going to get his completions. And those guys are going to get their catches. But they need to limit Yak, especially. But they also just need to sure tackling. Don't get beat deep. Don't get beat on a double move. Just keep the guys in front of you. Make the tackle. And I think the Ticats can get this win and get back to the Grey Cup, which I didn't think we'd be saying 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, it's like we always talk about. The pass rush needs to be better against Burris. If you want to beat Burris, you just have to get him flustered. He will make mistakes if he's worried about getting sacked. So, you know, it's going to be tough with our best pass rusher probably out for this game. Norwood Hickman's got to step it up a bit. And the guys in the middle, Laurent, and if it's Brian Hall or if it's Atkinson, they got to get some pressure up the middle. So Burris has had a great year, but he can be flustered and he will make mistakes if he's rushed. So if Burris is going to get the yards, like you said, but if we can make him make a couple mistakes, a couple turnovers, then we got a shot.
Well, Ted Laurent was an all-star, and John Gott was an all-star, and I think those guys are going to be lining up against one another quite a bit. And you throw Brian Hall into the mix. If they can collapse the pocket from the inside and not allow Burris to escape and make plays with his feet or extend the play, that's going to be what wins them this game. They, like you said, they need to get pressure, and I think it's got to come from up the middle, because with Norwood out, I don't think we're going to see as much pressure off the one side. Hickman, like you said, has got to step up, but I think it's up the middle where they need to really get to Burris, and if they can do that, I think we can get this win.
You know, my faith is up a bit. You know, I have a realistic approach. You know, we're the underdogs, but we got a shot. We got a shot at winning this game. So fingers crossed, and just hoping we can pull off the upset.
Every season that Ken Austin has coached this team, there's been some sort of adversity that this team has had to overcome, and they've been written off at various times for whatever reason. In 2013, it was all that lost practice time and the commute to Guelph, and there was no way this team could do anything coming off the 2012 season where they missed the playoffs, and then coming into this season where they quote-unquote didn't have a home. What did they do? They won 10 games, and they got to the Grey Cup. Sure, they got blown in the Grey Cup, but this was a team that wasn't expected to make the playoffs, and they got to the Grey Cup. Then last year, they had the slow start, and there was the delays in getting into the stadium because of delays in construction, and then there was, you know, half-used stadiums because everything wasn't fixed, and Caleros got hurt and missed time, and there was all this that brought into, I think they were a 1-6 team by Labor Day. What did they do? They rolled off 8 wins in their next 11 games, won first in the East, won the East final at home, got into the Grey Cup. Yes, they lost, but again, they still got there. And again, they were written off at various times during that season. It's no different than right now. This team was looking like an absolute juggernaut earlier in the season. And what happens? Unfortunately, we lose our best player, probably the league's best player, undoubtedly was going to be the MOP. And they stayed afloat for a while, but what happens? They come up against some adversity. They lose 3 in a row to enter the playoffs, and people are essentially writing them off, saying, well, they're just a speed bump on Toronto's road to a matchup with Ottawa. And what do? They shock everybody, and they get the win. And Brian Hall came out after the game and said he was angry that they were considered underdogs in their own home. And they have sort of embraced this underdog role, and they've been underdogs before, and they've gone up against much bigger odds than this and come out on top. So I'm not saying that they're going to win this game. I'm saying that if you write this team off and say that they can't win this game, you do it at your own peril, because this team has proven time and time again under Ken Austin that they can get the job done when the chips are down. And this is just another instance of Ken Austin writing his legacy as the head coach of this team. If he gets this win and gets this team, with all the adversity they have suffered this year, especially at the quarterback position, to the Grey Cup, they better start getting a chisel out and erecting a statue of him in front of Tim Hortons Field and putting this guy up for sainthood, because he will have done a remarkable job coaching this football team to get a team with their fourth string quarterback to the Grey Cup. But like I said, I'm not saying they're going to win. I'm just saying, don't say they can't. Anyone out there who thinks that Ottawa's just going to walk over these guys, you might be in it for a really big surprise.
Like you said earlier, I mean, every single writer on CFL.ca picked the Argos to win. So, you know, the experts, you know, they don't know everything, and the fans don't know everything. So this team can pull off a shocker against the heavily favored Red Blacks. And, you know, it comes down to the Red Blacks and the Ticats. Every CFL fan wanted to see this rematch, except, you know, Argonaut fans. But this is the high-profile game that everyone wanted to see, the rivalry that's been brewed up in the last two games in the season between these two teams. It's just going to be fun to watch, and I think it's going to be a great game.
All right, so let's get some bold predictions out there.
Okay, the defense gets 2 interceptions, 1 for a touchdown, and gets a forced fumble.
Okay, so mine's a little different. I am saying that the Ticats will outscore the Red Blacks in every quarter.
Interesting. So that'll obviously win then.
Exactly. Let's move on to our favorite segment, the questions from Twitter. You've got some questions. I've got some questions. Would you mind if I go first?
No, go for it.
All right. So these all come from Randy Rhino on the Three Down Nation comment section.
My boy.
Yeah, we haven't said his name in a while. I know we said we'd say it every week, and then we completely flopped on that. But yeah, Randy Rhino.
Randy Rhino is definitely not a bozo.
No, he's definitely not a bozo. So he sent in quite a few. We'll just go through them one by one here. So we got a couple Argos questions. We're going to start with Ricky Ray, and he asks, have we seen the last game with Ricky Ray in an Argos uniform?
I think we have. I think that this is Yeah, got to think that they're going to go with the younger guy, but I don't know if Trevor Harris is going to want to sign back the way that he's been. He was the MOP for the team, and then he doesn't start the last two games of the season in the playoffs. So maybe, I'm not sure if he wants to re-sign, but maybe they throw a bunch of money at him and he re-signs with the Argos. But I think that Ricky Ray needs more time to heal that shoulder. I don't think he's completely healed yet, and I think we'll see him in a different uniform next year.
All season long, I have said Ricky Ray is going to be the quarterback of the Montreal Alouettes next year, and I am reversing my tune. I think Ricky Ray is the starter for the Toronto Argonauts next year. I think we have seen Trevor Harris play really great, but when push came to shove, who did the Argos go to? They went with Ray. And I know that he's 36, and I know that they can't afford to bring both of them in there, but if I'm Scott Milanovich, and I'm Jim Barker, and I've seen Milanovich turn Trevor Harris into a viable starter and Zach Caleros into a viable starter, I got to think that he can work magic a third time and find another quarterback out there who they can turn into the guy to replace Ricky Ray. So I'm saying Ray re-signs with the Argos, probably at a much lower cap hit, probably with an incentive contract for games played and stuff like that. But I think number 15 is the Argos starter next year.
That's very interesting. You know, I could see it going either way, but I'm going to stand with Ray being in a different uniform. I don't know who, because Montreal, you know, has Glenn signed up. Maybe Glenn gets pushed aside like he has been a lot, and he's a backup there. But now I'm going to stick by that he's in a different uniform.
Okay, so we have another Argos question. Owens has been a non-factor, Chad Owens, that is. Other than a few highlight reel runs and catches, is his career winding down?
Well, yeah, I think it's winding down. He's getting up there in age. I don't think it's finished. I think he has a couple more years left in him. But, yeah, it's winding down. Once the receivers get to that age, they all start to wind down. So he might have 2 or 3 years left in him. I still think he's a pretty good player. I still think he's a pretty good receiver. I think maybe his punt return days are over. But I still think he can contribute in that receiving game.
Yeah, his days as a number one receiver back in, I think it was 2012, I think he led the league in receiving. His days as that are over. He is not going to be your highest paid receiver, no matter who he plays for. And I don't think he is the guy that they should have back there on kicks and punts. I think they should be looking at a younger, quicker guy, because Owens was all about shiftiness and speed. And as he gets older, that tends to go away. And I still think he can contribute, but as a number one receiver, yeah, his days are over there. So, yeah, his career is definitely winding down because he's just getting older. So this is a question that you and I have talked about kind of a bit over the last couple of weeks, and it is, will John Cornish be playing elsewhere in 2016?
I think he will. I think that this question would have been absolutely ridiculous at the start of the season. But like I said earlier in the podcast, I think that Jerome Messam might be the best player in the league right now. I think he hasn't played a bunch. You know, he might be 30 years old or something around that, but he hasn't taken the abuse that most starting running backs have at the age of 30. So I think he's playing his best ball right now. This is the peak of his career. You know, if he performs like he did last week in the game this weekend, and if they make it to the Grey Cup, then you got to think they go with Messam and Cornish signed somewhere else.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think Cornish is elsewhere next year. I think injuries have just taken their toll on him, and Messam has come in there. Now, Messam's also a free agent, so he might attract some interest elsewhere. But if I'm Calgary, I think I'm going with the guy who has proven to be healthy. And that's not a knock on John Cornish. He's had a great career, but injuries have derailed his last two seasons, and Jerome Messam has just looked like a beast out there since signing with the Stamps. He had 100 yards in one of his first games, or maybe it was his second game with the team, and then he was great against BC this week. And if he continues to go on this run and they get to the Grey Cup and win the Grey Cup and he has a big game, I could easily see him being named Grey Cup MVP. And if he is, I don't see a reason why you don't keep him around. So yeah, I think Cornish will be playing elsewhere next year, and I think Jerome Messam will be the starting tailback for the Calgary Stampeders. Okay, so if you ran the Saskatchewan Roughriders, what would your number one move over the offseason be?
Got to improve the Canadian talent. It just wasn't there this year. One of the big keys to having a successful franchise in the CFL, maybe the number one key, is having great Canadian talent. You know, we've seen it with Austin over the years. He stacks up on Canadian talent. There's a plethora of depth at that position. So if I'm them, I go get as much Canadian talent as you can through the draft, through free agency. Just get as much as you can, because it's a huge asset in the CFL.
They finished 3-15 this year, and they were not in the Enoch Mwamba sweepstakes because they did not have the cap room. So my first order of business is I'm shedding a bunch of those salaries. They re-signed a bunch of free agents this past offseason. Their free agent list was ridiculous, and they brought a lot of them back. But I'm shedding some salary, and there might be some fan favorite players that are no longer on this team. Tyron Brackenridge, I think I would consider letting go. Terrius George would be on the chopping block. And as crazy as this is to say, because he's coming off the last full season he played, he won a Grey Cup, but I think I would consider either releasing or finding a way to restructure Darian Durant's contract. They just have too many high-priced players on that team to be able to rebuild this squad in one offseason. I agree with you, their Canadian talent needs a massive upgrade. They have no depth behind any of their Canadian players. And once one of them got hurt, I think Shea Emery got hurt in like the first half of the first game. They were making crap up as they went along. It was ridiculous that the patchwork and band-aid solutions they had to come up with to start a number of Canadian players. But their cap situation is just out of this world. They spent to win the 2013 Grey Cup, and they won it, and everyone in Saskatchewan who's a Rough Riders fan would probably come out and say it was worth it. But they're not going to be able to turn this team around quickly like Ottawa did. Ottawa had a ton of cap space and opted to bring in a bunch of guys. Saskatchewan's going to have to shed a ton of salary, and that would be my first move. Get rid of some high-priced veteran players.
Yeah, and a guy, you know, I just said the Canadian talent has to improve, but a guy like Getzlaff is, you know, I heard a rumor that he was like the highest-paid receiver in the league. And he just doesn't deserve that money. He has been good over the years, but he's had the drops. He's pretty much every year, and he's been injured quite a bit. So I don't know where they stand with him, but he might be a guy that won't be in green and white next year as well.
So my last question to you is, would you be okay with an Ottawa-Hamilton Labor Day game?
No, it's Ottawa-Toronto. I know it's...
You mean Hamilton-Toronto.
Oh, Jesus. Yeah, Hamilton-Toronto. You know, it's changed a couple times over the years. You know, there was Hamilton-Montreal a couple years ago when they couldn't get Hamilton and Toronto because they're in Guelph or something. I can't remember. But
it was Skydome nonsense.
Okay, yeah. Thank God we don't have to deal with that anymore. But it has to be Hamilton-Toronto. It's tradition. It's one of the biggest games of the year. It's always sold out. Hamilton-Ottawa has a rivalry this year, but it's not the classic rivalry that Hamilton and Toronto have. So, no, it can't be Hamilton-Ottawa. It always has to be Hamilton-Toronto.
Maybe they should consider building up another weekend, like Thanksgiving weekend. Maybe make that another rivalry weekend. And maybe you put Toronto-Montreal together and Hamilton and Ottawa and, I don't know, Calgary and Saskatchewan for a while there. They had a bit of a rivalry going. And you can, maybe you build up like – because on Labor Day weekend, there's the three big games. There's Saskatchewan, Winnipeg, Toronto, Hamilton, and Calgary, Edmonton. And then you have that weird outlier, which usually seems to be BC and Montreal. There's no real rivalry there. And it takes place usually on a Thursday, so it's not even really joined up with the rest of the Labor Day weekend games. Maybe you try to do Thanksgiving as a different rivalry weekend. And – now that there's no scheduling conflicts and BS going down with the Skydome, it's all BMO Field, the schedule should be able to be much easier to work out. Maybe you make that an Ottawa-Hamilton rivalry game, and you build up Thanksgiving as sort of a second rivalry weekend.
Yeah, I like that idea a lot. You know, why not? They have games on Thanksgiving every year, or I think they had one game this year. But there should be two games, and it should be, yeah, like you said, Montreal-Toronto, Ottawa-Hamilton, a day before Saskatchewan, Calgary. You know, those two fan bases aren't friends by any means. They don't really like each other. So, yeah, I totally agree. They could build that up, and that could be another special, you know, weekend for the CFL. I don't see why they wouldn't want to do that. So the first one comes from Fernie635. We touched on this in the past episode. Should the Cats seek a veteran backup quarterback in the offseason?
We talked about this, like you said before. It all comes down to price. If it's too expensive to bring in a veteran, and it means it's going to cost the team a free agent like Courtney Steven or Ted Laurent or Bakari Grant or Justin Hickman. Like, this team's got a lot of free agents coming. This could be a very different-looking team come 2016. If bringing in a veteran, a Kevin Glenn-like person, or maybe Travis Lule or someone like that, if it's going to cost too much money, then I don't think you should do it. I think Caleros got hurt, and that sucks, but they're in the East Final again even without him, so no, I don't think they should go out and get a veteran QB unless the price is right.
You know, and it depends on how these playoffs go. If Mazzoli leads us to a Grey Cup and, you know, a Grey Cup win, fingers crossed, he's a free agent. They might want to bring him back, but he might want too much money. But it matters who's out there and how much they want. So I don't think they're going to do it, and I don't necessarily think they should do it. So Brian Broom asks, can you arrange to get Jeff Reinbold on for a few minutes? Think the fans would love it. Your show is an institution. I don't know about that. But, yeah, what do you think?
Well, I'd love to get Jeff Reinbold on the show. I'm going to give a little inside baseball. I don't know if you remember our conversations as we were going to start this, but you and I kind of wanted to make it just the two of us for the first little while so that we could develop some chemistry and sort of work out all the kinks. And I don't want to pat myself or yourself on the back too much, but I think we've done a pretty good job of evolving and getting better as the show has gone along. And the reason we haven't had guests or anything like that on is because of that. I wanted us to sort of, and you were the same way, to get a feel for one another so that we could make this the best show possible. But Brian, buddy, I know that you're buddies with Jeff Reinbold. If you want to get him on the show, just nudge him our way and we'll be glad to have him on. Maybe not at this time of the season because of how important it is, but maybe in the off season, if you could put in a good word for us, I know Mike or myself would be more than happy to talk to Jeff.
Like you said, it's a really important time of the year, but in the off season, I know Jeff's a really outgoing guy with a personality, so he'd be great to talk to, and he's done a hell of a job at the special teams in Hamilton, so I'd love to have him on the show. So yeah, maybe in the off season. Okay, another one from Brian. Chad Owens will be a free agent. If in another universe he signed with Hamilton, would Josh support him, embrace him, and encourage him?
Oh man, talk about a Kobayashi Maru. Oh man, I don't really know how to answer this question, honestly, because there have been players that have played for the Ticats that I have not liked. Adrian Obelli was one of them. I was never a really big fan of his. He was a good player and he made plays for the team, but I never really wanted him here. I always felt he was a little bit of a dirty player and I never really liked him. So I was kind of not so happy when he signed here. And then he went and signed with Toronto, so it made it easier to hate him again. But Owens, I'm not a fan of Owens. We've been over this a million times. Your story about meeting him in Moncton, though, softened me a little. It hardened me on hating Ricky Foley. So if he ever signs here, I don't care. He could come up to me personally and shower me with praise, and I would still tell him to go f*** himself. But I don't know. It would be hard. It would be really hard because I've spent so many years hating Chad Owens that I'd feel like such a hypocrite if he signed here and I ended up being like, you know, a supporter of him. But yeah, I can't really answer this question. I'm just hoping it never happens because I don't want to be put in that situation.
Yeah, I don't think you have to worry. I don't think he's going to come here. Yeah, I just don't see him signing with the Ticats. It'd be like you said about Foley. Like, he's my most hated player in the league. So if he signed with Hamilton, it would be similar to your feelings against Owens. It would just make me cringe. You know, I just don't like the guy as a player or a person. So Brian has another one. This one's for me. Mike, you moved west from PEI this year. Biggest difference of fan base and atmosphere there at Edmonton compared to Hamilton. Well, out east, there wasn't much of an atmosphere. There's no team out there. People are football fans. They tend to be NFL fans. I didn't meet many CFL fans out there. I was pretty much the only one. I met one guy that was a Stampeders fan that I worked with, and that was about it. You know, it's tough to create a fan base when there's no team in the area. So, yeah, there's not much of an atmosphere out there for CFL football. Now, Hamilton, there's you know, even it's in Southern Ontario, and that's a tough draw sometimes, but there's a really good fan base in Hamilton. You know this, living there. I think there's a great fan base in Hamilton, and I think there's a great fan base in Edmonton as well. You know, you see Edmonton gear all around town, like I'm sure you see Ticats gear all around in Hamilton. So I think Edmonton and Hamilton are great CFL cities that's really supportive of their team.
Yeah, I was kind of curious when you said this question. I was kind of wondering what Edmonton's fan base is like, because they also have the Oilers, who recently have been pretty terrible, but they still have to have a strong foothold in that city just based on the glory years of the 1980s. But the Eskimos are making this sort of resurgence, so I imagine that Eskimos fans are a lot more vocal and out there than maybe they were the few seasons before when they were maybe making the playoffs, but then there was a few seasons in there where they didn't make the playoffs. And it's nice to hear that Edmonton is really back to embracing the Eskimos, because I think that's one of the best CFL cities that we have in Canada.
You know, Edmonton in its heyday was like, you know, crazy. Commonwealth Stadium would have 40,000-50,000 people, I heard. And, you know, it's not quite at that level right now. You know, I went to a couple games this season, and the biggest crowd was 39,000 at the Labor Day rematch, but it was also a really good crowd considering it was pouring the whole game. So there's a really strong fan base out here, and I think it's just going to grow as the Eskimos gain more success. One from Jimmy. Jimmy, Canes Eagles won. What's the key to the beating the Red Blacks this time around? We touched on this in the game preview, so thanks for the question, Jimmy. But just listen to the podcast, and we've answered that question in the game preview. Okay, one from Joe, USFL Tecmo. 50 yards to win the big game. If you could choose any kicker in CFL history, who would it be?
Ooh. Do I go with recency bias and say Justin Medlock? Because that guy can kick a 50-yard field goal like most people can kick a soccer ball 2 feet.
Mm-hmm.
Ozzie was really good. Oh, boy. Oh, this Louis Pisaglia has nailed some pretty big field goals in his day.
Dave Ridgway.
Oh, man, there's so many good kickers. Sean Fleming.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, man. You know what? Because we haven't slurped him enough today, I'm taking Justin Medlock. That guy has one of the biggest legs I've ever seen. Give me Medlock for the game winner, 50 yards to win the Grey Cup.
That's a great decision. I got to go with Ozzy just because of the history of him making big kicks for the Ticats. He's, you know, the best kicker in Ticats history, maybe probably one of the best in the league ever. But yeah, there's so many out there that you could pick from, Basaglia, Ridgway. It's a hard decision, but I'm going to go with Ozzy. Okay, this comes from a fellow podcasters, Eskimos Empire Podcast. If Hamilton doesn't make it to the Grey Cup, who would you cheer for?
So that means Ottawa got in, and then we're down to Edmonton and Calgary in the West. I know he probably wants me and you to both say the Eskimos. And if they beat Calgary, I think that is who I would cheer for, because I've sort of grown to dislike Ottawa.
Mm-hmm.
They've gotten good, and they're a rival of ours now. And that has given me a little bit of hate for that team. So I think I'm just going to go with whoever wins the West Final.
Before the rivalry started between Ottawa and Hamilton this year, I might have said Ottawa because, you know, it's just been such a long time since an Ottawa franchise has won a Grey Cup. But, yeah, I'm going to have to agree with you. If Edmonton makes it, I'll cheer for Edmonton. If Calgary makes it, I'll cheer for Calgary because that means that Ottawa beat Hamilton, and I just can't. Yeah, like you, I've grown some hate for the Red Blacks. So yeah, probably if Edmonton's in it, I'll cheer for Edmonton.
Here's the thing: if it was Hamilton and Toronto or Hamilton and Montreal in the East Final, and this question came up, Hamilton doesn't make the Grey Cup, who are you cheering for? It'd be no debate. We're cheering for whoever wins the West. I would never cheer for the Alouettes, or definitely never cheer for the Argos. So why would I cheer for Ottawa? I respect what they've done. I'm glad they're back in the league. I've said that a bazillion times. But I don't want to see them win. They're in their second year. We haven't won a bloody Grey Cup since 1999. I don't want them coming in and winning it their second year. They don't get to have all that fun and all that excitement and all that happiness while we're sitting here miserable. So no, I'm taking the team in the West, and I'm always going to take the damn team in the West.
Screw Ottawa, and hopefully we won't have to cheer for any other team because hopefully it's Hamilton in the Grey Cup and third time's a charm. So, Oski Wee Wee.
Oski Wawa.
You know the rest.
Actually, you know what? Before we go, you have one more question, right?
I do not.
No? Okay. I thought you had one more about, like, hamburgers or something.
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. Yeah, that was the first question I got. So I was scrolling through my Twitter feed, and it was at the bottom here. Yes.
All right. Before you get to that one, I have a funny story. When we were leaving the game yesterday and walking down the street to go back to the car, there was a woman on we park on Gage Street. And there was a woman on Gage Street who was very excited about the game and decided to do the Oski Wee Wee chant by herself to nobody. There were people around, but she wasn't really, you know, you usually do the Oski Wee Wee and it's a call and response. Someone will say Oski Wawa, just like I did with you. She gets to the Holy Mackinac part and she says Holy Mackerel. And we heard her and we're like, what? Like, we just start talking about fish. It's a silly story, maybe only funny to me and the people that were I was walking with, but just hearing someone screw that up to me was really funny. And holy mackerel of all things, it's like, has nothing to do with fish.
Can't screw that up if you're a Ticats fan. Maybe if you're a fan of another team in the league and you don't know exactly what the chant is, but that can't be done. That's pretty funny.
She was wearing Ticats gear, so she's definitely a fan of the Ticats.
Oh, there you go. Now, our last question is a little fun. from Major League CFL, you're offered a hamburger or a hot dog at a barbecue. Do you go two dogs, two burgers, or one of each?
Well, I think conventional wisdom would say one of each. Then you get the best of both worlds. But your meat to food ratio is much better with a hamburger. There's more meat on a burger. I'm taking the hamburger. I'm taking two burgers. That's where I'm going.
Depends. Is it a jumbo dog? Now, if they should throw sausages in there, because I'd go with – I'm going to go one of each because I like the snot dogs and I like the hamburgers. So give me one of each.
Variety is the spice of life. Now, here's the big question, and this might be for everyone out there listening. If Mike answers this question wrong, I might be looking for a new podcast host. What do you put on your hot dogs?
Oh, I might get in trouble here. I am a plain Jane. I do not dabble in the condiments.
Okay, that's fine. I'm just glad you didn't say ketchup. Ketchup is for children. Grown men and grown women should not be eating ketchup. It doesn't belong on anything, except in the only instance I'm okay with ketchup.
Fries?
Meatloaf. On top of a meatloaf.
I go fries.
Fries work too. But I'm a gravy guy with fries. And I usually, you know, now everything comes with poutine. So there's really no point to the ketchup with the fries, because if the option is upgrading to poutine, I'm upgrading to poutine.
Now, I would go – actually, if I put some barbecue sauce on the hot dog too. I go – I like my Diana. She's my favorite. So I go the Diana sauce on the hamburger – or the hot dog.
Okay. So what type of Diana sauce are we talking? Original. We're talking original? Okay.
Yeah.
Sausages, I've been recently putting ranch, salad dressing, and Diana, either chicken and rib or original, depending on what is in the fridge, on a sausage. Man, oh, man. It's tough to beat that combo on a sausage.
Yeah, I don't play that game. I don't play the ranch game.
No, you're not a ranch guy?
No, I'm not a ranch guy. Huh. But to each their own.
All right. Well, at least you know what? We can agree to disagree on ranch. We agree on ketchup, and that's all that matters. Your job is safe, my friend.
Yeah, there you go.
So that was an excellent question and a ridiculous conversation to go out on. Yeah. So don't forget, as always, you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. And if you want to have one of your questions answered by myself or Mike, you can hit us up on Twitter. Mike, give them your Twitter handle.
Mike_Ticats.
And I am JoshSmith_82. I think we have opened Pandora's box when it comes to silly food-related questions. I would not be surprised if we're going to get some questions like that for the rest of the time we do this show. You can also post a question, food-related or otherwise, in the comments section of 3 Down Nation, and we will answer those on the show as well. I just want to give one more shout-out. We mentioned a couple weeks ago to the CFL Fans Fight Cancer event in Winnipeg during Grey Cup weekend. I just want to make sure that everyone is aware of that as well. It's Garbanzo's Pizza Pub on the Saturday before Grey Cup. I believe it is 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. in the afternoon. And Chris Walby will be there, and perhaps maybe some other CFL alumni. But again, great cause. Go out and support it if you're going to be in Winnipeg for the Grey Cup. If I was going to be going to Winnipeg, I'd be there mingling with some people and hopefully enjoying some good time and raising some funds for a really good cause. But that's it. So for Podski Wee Wee this week, I am Josh Smith.
And I'm Mike Graham. Eat 'em raw.
Eat 'em raw. Red, black, suck.
Yes.